Welcome to Legal Lens, a DebtWire podcast on legal issues impacting the restructuring and distressed industry at large. My name is Andy Serby. Today, we're taking a slightly different approach than our usual episodes. We're here to talk about the recent Supreme Court ruling in Harrington v. Purdue, in which the court rejected the pharmaceutical company's Chapter 11 plan by refuting the third-party releases contained within it. We have a lot to cover today, so we have two guests who I'll let introduce themselves. Bob, let's start with you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bob Rasmussen, and I teach corporate restructuring at the USC Gould School of Law.
Hi, and I'm Adam Zimmerman. I'm the Robert Kingsley Professor of Law, also at USC Gould School of Law, where I teach mass torts and administrative law.
Great. By way of quick background, first I want to ask, before we got this SCOTUS opinion, what was the status or the favorability of these types of releases in bankruptcy law in general? This is probably a better question for you, Bob.
Yeah, I'd say mixed is the right answer. There were some courts that clearly allowed these in appropriate circumstances, such as the Second Circuit in Purdue. And there were other courts, such as the Fifth, the Tenth, and D.C., which did not allow them. So the courts were split on this. Of course, when people decided where to file, if they needed a third-party release, they would tend to go to a jurisdiction that said they would approve them.
Sure. And given that status, we have spilled a lot of ink in the legal journalism game about mass torts and bankruptcies. So maybe for you, Adam, given the availability and the status of these types of releases, just how big of a tool from your perspective is bankruptcy and mass tort, or was it before this opinion?
Well, bankruptcy's always played a very significant role in mass torts, dating at least back to the 1990s, when asbestos companies began to see bankruptcy as essentially a central tool for resolving a lot of their liabilities, and the Congress created a statute that created a provision by which that they could do so. A bankruptcy, along with class actions, multi-district litigation, government-based litigation, altogether have always kind of played a strong hand in doing so. More recently, bankruptcy has become a significant place to do something that we're always trying to do in mass torts, which is to try to get a global resolution, a final kind of piece for resolving large numbers of claims that are filed all over our federal courts, but also our state courts. And one thing that bankruptcy at least held the promise of doing in combination with third-party releases that couldn't necessarily happen in multi-district litigation or class actions is it could come up with a final and binding resolution for everyone, regardless of where the cases were filed. Class actions always, you know, at least since the 1990s, always have an opportunity for a party to opt out. And in multi-district litigation, that's a process by which in federal courts, all the cases can be centralized in the federal court. It was limited to the federal courts or the state courts in which they were filed. So bankruptcy, relying on the third-party release, could be a place where a debtor could wrap up all its liabilities alongside a number of other parties who might have been at least partially responsible for the mass tort. And so it's significant in that this decision at least cuts back a little on the ability for bankruptcy to provide that kind of global kind of resolution that really hadn't been available in other settings.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting right into the discussion of the actual opinion, let's go back to you, Bob, give you a break, Adam. What were your immediate thoughts when you saw the ruling?
Quite frankly, I was disappointed. I think the statutory interpretation issue in the case is a close one. I had always hoped the court would not take this case to resolve that issue, simply because we all know about the harm caused by opioids. There was $6 billion on the table, albeit over time, that would go to the states and to the affected parties. None of that money has been distributed. It was all on hold pending the release. And by virtue of the court's opinion, that plan is blown up. I know the parties are back trying to get a new settlement, unclear if they will, but the immediate effect was more delay for the victims of the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Adam?
I was surprised by the opinion. I thought and expected a narrow decision here that would favor Purdue because the deal seemed to be a pretty good deal, without opining more broadly on what this would mean for the appropriate use of third-party releases in other circumstances. The statute uses the word appropriate, so I thought the court could hang its hand on the word appropriate and say, well, in this unique setting here, appropriate, but you know, we're not going to try to really disrupt the world with respect to the other potential appropriate uses of releases. So I was surprised because instead of a narrow victory that I thought would kind of support Purdue, it ended up being a much more broad ruling that went the other way. The broader consequences for mass torts, I think, are unclear. I don't know that it will necessarily be all that disruptive to the way in which mass torts are typically resolved, because at least in the mass tort setting, in almost all these other forms in which we're trying to resolve large numbers of cases, we never really get 100% participation anyway, and defendants seem to be okay with that. So maybe that's what we'll start seeing in bankruptcy. We'll get a large number of people participating. Bankruptcy will still continue to be this place that has the power to just bring everyone together, which is itself a really important thing, just bringing everyone to the table. But it won't have the same type of promise that at least some in the mass tort world, particularly some defendants, were hoping for.
Right.
I think that's right, that you can still get a lot of things done in bankruptcy. One question making the rounds, trying to get this global settlement that Alan talks about, is can you do the following? There are jurisdictions, most notably the UK, that do allow for non-consensual releases in their plans of arrangement. And people have been speculating you can get a company with extensive tort liability, file a scheme of arrangement in the UK, get your third party, non-consensual third party releases there, and then file a Chapter 15 petition in the United States asking the court to recognize the UK proceeding. Does that work? We don't know. There's a provision of Chapter 15 which says the court can refuse to grant recognition when recognition would be manifestly against public policy. Would that be manifestly against public policy? Your guess is as good as mine.
It's a heck of a lot farther taking your case to the UK versus White Plains, New York, you know?
I still think they can afford the plane tickets.
Adam, you had some add on there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one thing that the Supreme Court hinted at, but never squarely addressed, was the role in which due process was a factor in reaching. I mean, this is a decision that relies entirely on the statute, and it ultimately concludes that the courts don't have the power to issue third-party releases in the statute. We know that we have another congressional provision that for asbestos bankruptcies is handled differently. But, you know, there is a little bit in the opinion that kind of hints at due process concerns. I suspect that another potential issue might be like, oh, is there a due process problem? In addition to the public policy type of argument. And I don't know which members of the court would buy that or what type of due process argument would have to be made.
I do have one other bankruptcy fallout question for you, Bob, which is we're seeing this get cited everywhere, whether someone's objecting because of it or someone saying like preemptively, we don't run afoul of it. I saw an example earlier this week where a company was trying to differentiate a channeling injunction from a situation like this. It was the Bird Global case where they have a bunch of settlements with municipalities for tort claims. And I was wondering how significant you think the fallout will be when it comes to cross citations and that kind of thing.
I think the interesting question is what's going to count as consent, because we still allow for consensual settlements. There are a lot of parties here. What do you do about the people who don't say anything? You know, right now, what usually happens is you send them notice and you say, look, if we don't hear from you, we'll deem that you consented. If that's valid, you're still going to get a lot of work done in the bankruptcy because a large number of these creditors just don't file. They just don't pay attention. Mm-hmm. So if that counts as valid consent, I still think there's going to be a lot of workarounds. You're going to get, you know, 97% of the way you were there pre-Purdue. If that doesn't count, if that's just fictional consent, if that, as Adam indicates, may violate someone's due process, then you can have a lot more problems because in a lot of these cases, the number of creditors that actually voice what they want is a relatively small percentage. I think in Purdue itself, the opioid victims, the response rate was less than 30%.
Makes total sense. Moving kind of along the opinion lane here, does the split of justices on the supporting versus the dissenting side kind of surprise you, tell you anything about the opinion? What do you think about? And also, like, who was selected to write the respective opinions? Let's go to Adam on this one first.
The particular makeup of the majority and the dissent actually didn't surprise me that much. It's not uncommon in, you know, one of the other courses I teach is civil procedure, and it's not uncommon in the world of civil procedure to see unusual bedfellows between liberal and conservative justices when it comes to certain procedural questions. And we see that here. You know, we see unusual group in the majority in the dissent writing the opinion. It wasn't unexpected for me to see conservative and liberal justices both favoring the petitioner's arguments here as well as the respondents. I think that one thing that was a little bit unusual when one looks at the majority opinion is a very textually driven opinion. It looks at the statute. It thinks about traditional rules of statutory interpretation in order to determine whether or not the courts have this power. Towards the end, there's a few pages kind of thinking about like the broader implications for bankruptcy and policy, but it's largely an opinion about that's kind of grounded in the text of the statute. So to the extent I was surprised a little bit there was that the majority opinion was joined by some members of the court who aren't avowed textualists. The dissent surprised me because the dissent, which I think is almost three times longer than the majority opinion, was the complete opposite of that. It's not a textually driven opinion. It's written by another conservative Supreme Court justice. And most of it's about policy and the need for coordination and collective action problems that bankruptcy is meant to resolve. And then about halfway to maybe two-thirds of the way through the opinion, you get to the text of the statute. And that's where the two opinions are kind of engaging each other. So to the extent I was surprised, it's like it's a scrambling not only of like kind of the traditional alliances among liberal and conservative justices, but in the methods that they traditionally use to kind of come to resolve the cases that come in before them. And you know, I was surprised that some of the more liberal members signed on to a majority opinion that was avowedly textualist, and I was a little bit surprised to see at least some of the conservative members joining a dissent that was much more policy oriented and kind of focused on the pragmatics of bankruptcy.
Yeah, I would say if you look at the Supreme Court's bankruptcy jurisprudence, the basic takeaway is usually they don't care about bankruptcy. Usually bankruptcy cases are just a vehicle for them to have discussions about what's the appropriate method of statutory interpretation. And a lot of their well-known textualist opinions come in the bankruptcy context where they're just, as in Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion, just really talking about how you approach statutory text. What I found interesting in Purdue was the dissent really cared. This is one of the few bankruptcy cases where I see the Supreme Court diving in, trying to figure out what bankruptcy is all about. I get the sense that at least some of the people at the dissent were working under the impression, which I think is the right one, that this was a good deal for the opioid victims. And we're trying to think through how could we preserve this, as opposed to just using this case as a vehicle to pontificate on what's the appropriate way to read words in the statute.
One more thing. No, another interesting thing for me as someone who just kind of thinks about courts and procedure and mass torts and how they're resolved is there's always been this kind of vacillation between experiments in procedure that are used to resolve large groups of cases that afford courts like a lot of discretion in different places of the procedural system that allows judges to have a lot of discretion to experiment. Because these cases are complicated and often require like a lot of creative handling. And on the other side of the spectrum, rules that are meant to cabin judicial discretion and provide, you know, transparency and stability and essentially help the parties know how they're kind of the case will predictably unfold. And we see this over time in class actions and in MDLs, like this occasionally the swing towards having more discretion. Like in class actions, we had a lot of mass tort class actions in the 80s and 90s, and then comes back after Amquez and Ortiz towards rules. Like we got to look at the rules. And I kind of feel like this opinion reflects this kind of tension among the different members of the court as to how much power and how much discretion exists in the rules versus like how rule-bound we're going to be, at least with respect to this particular question. It'll be interesting to see as more mass torts kind of eventually make their way up to the appellate courts and maybe the Supreme Court, how the court will continue to resolve that. To what extent should courts have power and discretion to resolve unusual cases coming before them? To what extent do we need to rigidly adhere to rules of procedure, and limiting what courts can do?
I would just follow up on that and say that tension has always been in bankruptcy, that historically bankruptcy were courts of equity. And you often hear bankruptcy judges referring to themselves as, sitting in a court of equity, going to more the discretion element, where the appellate courts routinely tell the bankruptcy judges, no, you have to follow the statute.
This case, in a way, reminds me of a phrase I've heard thrown around by a couple of courts, which is they see a big tangled thing come in front of them and they'll get these hotly contested groups in front of them. And then they say, this begs for a commercial solution, which is basically just them begging you to settle, right? And here we had a commercial solution with broad consensus that ended up clashing with the statute and the text all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the begged for commercial resolution that a lot of bankruptcy judges would probably have wanted, they get told it doesn't work anymore.
I think that's right. And Purdue is unusual. You know, Purdue, there was a small number of very motivated dissenters who were willing to push this very far. Mm-hmm. On a lot of cases, you could imagine a situation where that commercial consensus would have carried the day. It's often difficult to generalize from Purdue what's going to happen in other cases, because it's rare that you see officers and directors taking such what seem to be just egregious actions, people be harmed by them, and people not really wanting to vindicate their economic interests, but quite frankly, wanting to go to court and litigate and have a judgment that sets forth the ways in which these actors harmed their loved ones.
Mm-hmm. And I'll add, this is Purdue and the opioid litigation more broadly is very public in character. These are largely public plaintiffs. The federal cases involved just under 3,000 municipalities and counties, Native American tribes. Originally, there were states filing in the federal courts, but all 50 states' AGs or 49 state AGs had filed lawsuits themselves. We're seeing a movement like this in mass tort litigation as we're seeing more and more public plaintiffs bringing cases and using kind of the economies of scale of a governmental entity that we might see parties when they bring a class action, trying to use economies of scale to bring a large case. So these cases are already more political and public and impact the public interest in a way that we might not see in other types of commercial settings. And I think that ultimately kind of changed the dynamic and maybe even the willingness of some of those participants to litigate all the way up. I think many of the states, but as the case was evolving, ended up settling, as did most of the municipalities. But as we see these other kind of public plaintiff cases in other areas, from vaping to social media litigation to climate change litigation, you can expect that the litigation will take more aggressive and unusual turns, that there'll be less willingness to settle, in part because the implications cut more broadly than what you might see in a more traditional commercial case.
So now we're going to break out the crystal ball and do kind of a looking forward lightning round, which is, we've already kind of gotten into the topic of how this will affect Chapter 11 and torts going forward. But first question is going to be more towards Bob, which is, how do you see this in a broad sense affecting plan approaches kind of going forward?
It's going to be interesting to see how many people try the Chapter 15 route, go to a foreign jurisdiction that does allow these releases and see if you can get a U.S. court to bless them. There's a Second Circuit case from 2018 where Judge Glenn did bless non-consensual third-party releases under Chapter 15, and a case that had a high degree of votes in favor of it. Whether that carries over, we'll see. But, you know, somebody's going to try it.
Absolutely. For really either one of you, let's do Adam, just to give you a break, which is, where does Purdue go from here?
That's an interesting question. I expect that the parties will go back to the drawing board. And I think based on the number of parties that were willing to agree to the original settlement, that we'll see another settlement. We'll see another settlement. And that settlement will take longer. It won't
have 100% participation. And so whatever the settlement is might be less than what you would get if you had 100% participation. How big that settlement is, I don't know. But I'm kind of optimistic that there'll still be one because, as I was kind of mentioning before, all of these other settings and the way in which we resolve really big cases, defendants are pretty happy to settle 90 to 95% of their liability, which I'm sure they can get large numbers of plaintiff attorneys to agree to, and then litigate the rest, you know, the remaining 5%. And even in the context of the opioid litigation, we've seen that already happen. So, you know, another big wave of lawsuits were brought against not just Purdue, but all the major distributors of opioids. And they settled in a massive $40 plus billion settlement, which ultimately got about 90% of participation from all the cities and the states. And that was essentially their walkaway point. So I'm assuming we're going to get something like that. We'll get a settlement. We'll get a settlement that might not be quite as high as a settlement that would have been reached if we had 100%. But it still might be something that's ultimately satisfying enough for the defendants and the plaintiffs to reach a deal and to distribute the funds.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're running a little bit short on time, but we'll take the last question, same question, but this side to you, Bob.
Yeah, one thing that I'm interested in is the interest of the Sacklers. Up to now, the Sacklers have been aligned. All the family members wanted the settlement. There were only about 9 or 10 family members that are actually running Purdue, people who could be sued directly. For all the other family members, if they reach a settlement with Purdue, they're out. Though the people don't have direct claims against them. So you wonder if behind the scene there's some tension between those family members who could write a check and get for themselves global peace, and then the few faculty family members who actually are going to face litigation against them for actions they took as officers and directors of Purdue.
Absolutely. You can't really have Purdue without a heavy discussion on the Sacklers. That's the whole point of this, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to both of you today. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts and your expertise with us.
Thanks for inviting us. It was fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And a big thanks to our listeners, as always, for checking out this episode of Legal Lens. We'll see you next time.